Full Service Radio is supported by Compass, the future of real estate in the Metro DC area and beyond. Discover more at compass.com.
Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio.
Hola, friends. Welcome to Shift Drink on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C.
No, you first.
I need to introduce myself. I'm Eddie Kim, D.C. writer, impatient optimist, and snooty barman about town.
And I'm Matthew Ramsey, porn burger chef, waffle advocate, and illegal mezcal ambassador. Long hours and on sore feet. Cramped side by side in the pursuit of perfection is typical in the service industry. But it isn't till the final diner has gone and the last tab is closed, when there are no more pots to scrub or glasses to polish, that's when the first shift drinks are poured and the stories start to flow.
Every week we share a shift drink and swap war stories from behind the line with chefs, bartenders, bakers, and brewers, and pretty much anyone who touches this all-encompassing industry. This week, we set our alarms a bit earlier in the morning and jump from night owl to early bird as we are joined by Larry Weaver, king of the Java bean at Coronation Coffee, roasted here in the district.
He is no regular Joe.
Thank you, gentlemen.
The puns just keep on coming.
That's a coffee joke.
Is that your favorite coffee joke?
I was the worst one I've heard, actually. So there's a lot of room for
nailed
room
it. For So, per the name of our podcast, we will start off talking about our shift drink for the day.
Yes.
So, what are we drinking?
We are drinking Tuk Tuk, which is an international style lager brewed by DC Brow exclusively for Maketo, which is one of my main coffee partners. They just released it probably about 2 weeks ago, and I don't want to seem like too much of a shill, but it's actually exactly what I would go for at the
it's
end of a shift.
Super crushable.
Yeah. It's a beautiful can.
Yeah.
Beautifully designed by the fine creative team at Foreign National. And frankly, at the end of a shift, I would typically go for something like a Tiger.
Yeah.
I think this replaces that quite nicely. It's super crisp, really drinkable.
I feel like it pairs well with other things. And we love us some DC Brow. So.
Yeah. I guess for Maketo specifically, for their style of food, which is a little bit Southeast Asian, Taiwanese food, it pairs up better with Asian food. There's a little bit of rice that's thrown into the mash.
Yep.
Gives it a little bit of sweetness, a little bit of lightness.
Yeah, I would say especially right now, the menu is very spice heavy. Our CDC, Mario, has been crushing the food game over there. So this past week, I just got blown up with a couple of spice bombs. So this came in handy.
Perfect.
Great.
And I haven't seen this. Is this sold exclusively at Maketo /
Exclusively at Maketo for now. Okay. I believe we have plans for serving it here at the Line Hotel as well.
Awesome.
Don't quote me totally on that. But
it's live. You've already been quoted. So
It's going to happen.
Well, it's fantastic. And Eddie Kim, what else are we drinking here? You brought in a little surprise treat.
A little bit of surprise. Originally, the first idea that Larry told us for a shift drink was a Trinidad Sour, which is a little bit of a difficult drink to make. Compared to most other cocktails that use some kind of spirit like bourbon or gin, this actually is all bitters, all Angostura bitters, which is, you can use it as a spirit in itself. It's 44.7% alcohol.
I didn't know it was that high, but I guess that makes sense for all the...
Right, but because under FDA laws, it's non-potable, mm-hmm. You can sell it in
grocery stores.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Trinidad Sour, it's one of my favorite drinks to order from cocktail bars, especially if I know that they've got the larger bottle of bitters, but definitely hard to make, so I don't always order it. But
right.
It's one of my favorite that Eddie makes for me, so
thanks.
You know, sorry.
Well, right now we just kept it really simple, and we're just taking shots of it, so.
Shots of bitters, yes.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Oh. Yeah, that's good. It reminds me of like taking a shot of Underberg. It's a little pep in your step.
certainly a little pep.
Puts a little burn in the...
The urn?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for that.
All right. So, another step to get to know you better. We have asked you to prepare two truths and one lie for us. You ready?
Nice. That was early, guys.
Hey, we're jumping to the good stuff.
You know, I actually did prepare for this because I know you've had some guests that weren't too prepared, so let me just jump in.
Two truths, one lie.
Got how it is.
I feel like we go. Every time somebody is prepared, though, they've like prepared to like fuck with us. So like, I'm not feeling any better about this situation.
That's fair. So my two truths and a lie. Number one, my first trip to Central America ended in a 3-hour mountainous winding road trip back to the airport while sick with a bacterial parasite. That's number one.
It's very specific.
Number two, I've stodged at Jordan Kahn's Destroyer in Los Angeles, a really great breakfast, lunch, and dinner spot in Culver City. And number three, I've showered in the bathroom at Sally's middle name.
I know you're at Sally's a lot. It's also the shortest one, which usually means that's true.
I might have some insider. Actually, maybe. I'm going to say the first one is not true.
It was like very long and very well thought out. It sounded like a lie I would tell my parents in high school. I'm going to say that's a lie.
Yeah, but parasites are always funny and it's always a good gag. So I think getting parasites would be...
It sounds like you've already committed to the parasites.
I've committed.
Do we Let's need go to... parasites. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that is the truth.
Oh, wait. Damn it.
Sorry, guys. Yeah.
Keeping the streak alive, guys.
Just what is
it's
that?
It's the bitters. The bitters made me do
0 for 15.
Was it Destroyer?
It is Destroyer.
Damn it.
And I actually stole that one. My good pal Ed from Milk Cult stodged the Destroyer. And I was like, you know what? That seems believable enough.
That was a little bit of a gut reaction. I should have gone with that.
I will say Destroyer, one of the better meals I had in... 2017, so shout out Destroyer.
Right on. Now I've read some stuff about Angostura, and Angostura is actually really good for killing parasites, so it would have been on theme.
Would have been a no. Nothing was really staying down whenever I was on that trip. The winding roads of Guatemala in the back of a rickety van was not the way I wanted to spend the last day of vacation.
That is brutal.
Sounds fun to me though.
That was actually the reason I brought that up is because that was the trip that sort of made me fall in love with coffee. I went to Guatemala, Antigua, and Lake Atitlan for a friend's wedding and ended up touring some coffee farms while I was there. And that was sort of the like key
your aha moment.
Yeah, that was when I was like, you know, maybe I don't want to keep doing government computer work for the rest of my life.
Before that, you were more of a tea guy?
Not even really a lot of coffee, to be honest with you. Just like, you know.
Well, I mean, What was it about that moment? Well, I mean, was it just seeing the production? Was it just kind of experiencing it for the first time with that?
Yeah, it was understanding the amount of work and labor and love that went into producing high-quality specialty coffee. I think, like, so often we think about coffee as being this sort of commodity that's there to wake you up, but especially in the world that I sort of exist in with roasting, there's just so much work that goes into it at the source, and so that was... a really aha moment for me.
And when was this?
This was in 2014. And after that trip, I came home and I got a little electric roaster that I just roasted on my countertop and did that for about a year, and kind of the rest is history.
I think that's might have been, when I was meeting you. I think you were kind of early stages of roasting.
Very early stages, very bad coffee coming out of that roaster. But that's how it starts, you know? And then I picked up a job at Peregrine Espresso on weekends, learning the sort of barista side of things because, you know, roasting is one aspect, but learning what happens at the end user level was really important for me. So I did that for about a year while I also was still working for the government, and then quit to do full-time roasting.
When did you do the full turnover?
I did the full turnover in about December of 2016. I took a cross-country road trip with my friend Emily to like, see the country, and then I came back and dove headfirst into it.
Ready to roast. What now? Explain to our listeners and the guests in the hotel, break down Coronation for us.
Break down Coronation. So Coronation was started in December of 2016 alongside man you may well know, Eric Bruner Yang. He and I are business partners in Coronation. And the thought behind it was actually to provide coffee for his restaurant here at the hotel, Brothers and Sisters. And it sort of expanded beyond that when we realized that, you know, for the most part, coffee in restaurants is pretty mediocre to bad in a lot of restaurants. And so we wanted to improve that. And so what we sought out to do was work with restaurant partners that we felt like fit into the ethos of what we wanted to do. And we're moving right along. But it was initially make better coffee for restaurants and has sort of grown from there to include.
I mean, that is so true. Like, you spend all this time work composing dishes and baking, and I'm talking like days and days of prep for a meal or a bite. And then at the end of it, you're served this bitter, overcooked cup of coffee that just is like, that's the last impression you'll have of your time at this space. And it's very often overlooked.
Now, why do you think that is? Was it good before, and then it just fell backwards, or was it just never good?
I think much like desserts at a lot of restaurants, it was kind of an afterthought, which is not true as much anymore, especially in DC and all over. I think there's been a great renaissance in desserts and pastry chefs being more sought after and expected to do really great things for a restaurant. I think for coffee, truthfully, a lot of it comes down to price. Restaurateurs don't necessarily want to spend money on making good coffee. Oftentimes they don't want to take the time to do it really well. And that's been part of my challenge, right? Working with restaurants is creating a system to make coffee really good, really easily, because oftentimes you have servers or back of house making it, and they want it to be as easy as possible to make something that's delicious. So that's something that I've spent a lot of time working and perfecting, so that whenever I get to a restaurant, they have a really easy way to produce.
You're not necessarily trying to change people's minds per se.
I'm just trying to make it better. I think plenty of chefs that I've talked to understand and know that the coffee product that they're putting out isn't great, but they're not always, I guess, approached to do it better from roasters. So I think it's also a price thing. A lot of the places that I've been talking to are buying coffee for $6.50, $7 a pound. And for specialty coffee, like I work in, and places like Vigilante and Small Plains work in, it's closer to like $9.50 to $10 a pound. So it's a big ask to kind of increase the price that when they've been so used to paying so little.
You're a very local roaster. Guessing you rub shoulders with other roasters in town. Are there other people in the space in DC that you're a fan of, an advocate of, or?
Absolutely. I love Small Plains coffee. You know, obviously I worked for Peregrine Espresso for about a year and a half, so those guys are my homies. I just love what they're doing. So they're my favorite. They were, if I had to pick one DC roaster besides myself, it would be them.
That should have been our Mary Fuck Kill.
I mean, you can still do that, but I would both marry and fuck Small Plains.
Okay.
And then kill them afterwards.
Yeah.
And then also kill them afterwards, because they're
my competition.
I feel like they're the competition that I'm most jealous of.
Right on. Yeah.
They do such a good job.
But that's what drives us, right?
Well, that kind of leads us to the next question of what is your philosophy when it comes to your roasting, and how is that a little bit different from anyone else?
Yeah.
Small Plains, for instance.
You know, I think that I want to try to offer something for everyone. While I want to honor the work that's done at the origin level, I think, like, especially in America right now, there's an expectation that there will be some more developed, richer tones in coffee that sometimes mask what is done at origin. And I think certain American roasters will roast really light in order to enhance that. And I think I'm more willing to work across the spectrum of roast levels in order to meet what people are looking for.
What does that mean?
Yes. So we'll start with something like Starbucks, where you go into a Starbucks here in DC and you're going to get a cup of coffee. If you order a black coffee, it's going to be pretty roasty, little smoky.
Right.
But it's going to taste exactly the same way if you get that same cup of coffee in Japan. And for me, what I love about coffee is that a coffee grown in Peru is not going to taste like a coffee grown in Ethiopia if you roast it to the degree that it enhances those flavors.
Yeah. And each region kind of specifically has its own flavor palette, essentially, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And much like with wine and different varietals and terroir, all of that plays a factor in coffee. And so my goal as the roaster, is to enhance those flavors and express what makes those coffees unique. But then even within that, there are some coffees, for example, that taste better when they're roasted longer or more developed.
Yeah.
And so it's my job to seek out those coffees and roast them in that way in order to provide that product for customers that are looking for
gotcha.
It.
Gotcha. Okay.
So I definitely have the super light roasted, high grown Ethiopian coffees that are like really light, fruity, almost tea-like. Mm-hmm. And then I also have the like super chocolate bombs that are, you know, South American.
Obviously, you're going to have your own preferences. I know on your arm you have tattooed your favorite aromatics and flavors. Do those flavors still hold true? And what are those?
That's yes. That's a piece of trivia that not a lot of people know about me. Actually, I try to keep the coffee tattoo a little hidden. But thank you.
For the record, Larry is now sweating. He's in a hot seat.
He's wearing multiple layers. Well, covered up.
I think that it's a bit of a cliche amongst coffee people and baristas to have like a coffee plant tattoo or, you know, a portafilter tattoo. And so I tried to make mine a little more subtle. But Matthew's correct. Yeah, I have kind of an ode to my favorite coffee origin notes. And that actually still holds true 2 years later. It's a lot of, you know, watermelon, jasmine, lemon, citrus florals. Those are sort of what I look for in my coffees. I think they're the most interesting aspects of what makes coffee unique.
Eddie, do you know where those flavors come from? Is that one region or no?
Yeah. It is in fact one region of coffee growing.
Oh, we're talking about Ethiopia, right?
Yeah.
I would classify it more generally as East African coffees, but yes, Ethiopia and Kenya are they're the two coffee origins that kind of made me fall in love with coffee, and the idea of sort of instilled in me the idea that coffee can be roasted to a spectrum, to
the birthplace of coffee.
Yeah.
I actually went out to Ethiopia, and one of the things that when I was out there that I wanted to do was to see a plantation. Mm-hmm. and kind of get that sense of like, What is coffee besides just, you know, dark energy water, and kind of see the process, but also to experience they'll do the coffee roasting ritual mm-hmm. in their houses. And it's incredibly unique and special. It's pretty wild.
It's a very unique experience for sure. And I know Sadamo over on Eat Street still performs that every Sunday.
Right on.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it is really cool.
Yeah.
I think that ritual really does add a whole nother level of experience that for most part, 99% of the coffee that we drink, we don't see.
I mean, I think that every person that drinks coffee, especially people that drink coffee at home, have some type of ritual or ceremony, regardless of whether it's like as intricate as something that you would perform in Ethiopia or, you know, your daily pour over that you do, or frankly, putting a K-cup into a Keurig and brewing. Yeah. Like, there's something uniquely ceremonial or ritualistic about that, and obviously the way that it makes you feel after you.
I mean,
there are two coffee producers, ritual over in San Francisco, right, and ceremony in Baltimore,
right,
or Annapolis. They've named their coffee or their roasteries after what we all take for granted.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's kind of common verbiage amongst coffee roasters across the world, because I think that's what really connects everyone.
Sure.
You know, coffee that I make here is going to be similar to the way that they produce it in Norway or, you know,
Zen and the art of brewing.
It can be a very Zen experience for sure. I think,
always going back to Japan.
I didn't want to say it because I had already brought it up.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break here. I'm Matthew Ramsey, and I'm here with Eddie Kim and Larry Weaver of Coronation Coffee. When we get back, first, second, third, and perhaps fourth wave.
Uh-oh.
Original music from Kido here on the break. That's KIEDO on SoundCloud. SoundCloud.com/Kido. We'll be right back.
Hey.
Full Service Radio is supported by Compass. Discover Compass, America's first modern real estate company. By pairing the industry's top agents with technology, Compass delivers an incomparable client experience from the first-time buyer to the seasoned seller. Visit them today in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, or navigate compass.com day or night.
Welcome back, listeners. You're joining us here with Shift Drink. I'm here with Matthew Ramsey and Larry Weaver of Coronation Coffee. We left off our discussion about ritual and ceremony, but now we want to talk about the waves of coffee.
Yeah. So, I mean, in your opinion, where's coffee going next, Larry? We live in a period of unicorn frappuccinos, glitter lattes, and hot buttered coffee, sometimes even infused with cannabis, as we do here in the studio.
Quite liberally.
What's the next wave of coffee? And maybe even talk about what the first three were.
You know, I probably can't talk about what the first wave was because honestly, I'm not familiar with it whatsoever. Yeah. I think like second and third wave are probably the most prominently known. In my opinion, I hate to even talk about what I think the fourth wave will be because I think it can kind of be cliche to talk about it. But what I think is coming in specialty coffee is automation. There are a lot of people that will sort of plant their flag behind the idea that the coffee should be manual and specialized and requires a really unique skill set. And what I think is coming is just full automation.
So the pendulum almost swings back the other way because
that was what first wave was about.
Yeah. First wave was, I guess your Folgers and your Maxims, right?
Sure.
Or was that
Maxwell?
Definitely not Maxim.
Folgers and Maxwell's.
I guess I understand what you were looking at before we started the show, but yeah, sort of like instant coffee, really quick, dirty, just cup of mud,
right,
you know?
Right.
And I think in specialty specifically, I say automation because with automation comes better service for the end user, right? I think oftentimes, especially when people think about third wave coffee, they think about the sort of like snooty, tired, you know, intellectual barista type that doesn't really care what the customer wants, and they're kind of like there to do coffee and coffee only. And I think that's not really always a great experience for people. And I think the more we can automate the process, the better we can serve the end user and provide a better experience for them in the coffee bar.
I'll tell you, for the bartending world, we've gone through that exact same.
I was going to bring that
evolution
up.
Where now it's no longer cool to be a snooty bartender,
right?
With our mustaches.
All right, Matthew. I see your gaze.
Yeah,
brutal.
Yeah, I know. Not all of us have mustache wax, but and the armbands. Now it's about let's see how quickly we can get a drink in your hands because you're going to be happier. We're going to make more money. It's good for everyone.
I was going to talk about like just pouring in general because like free pouring versus like measuring and stuff like that is like now more prominent. I mean, I feel like measuring is more prominent than free pouring.
That's about consistency. That's a very controversial, almost people take sides on what school they came from on the free pour side or the jiggering side.
That's the thing is that, I mean, even in automation, you want to be able to have consistent measurements time mm-hmm. after time. And I think one of the big problems with coffee bars and sort of the idea of doing manual pour overs or whatever is that there's a large inconsistency in the way that people are preparing these drinks. So the more we can automate that process and set recipes, the better.
Yeah.
You know, and for me, to speak to sort of like providing a really quick drink or like really good customer service, I think that there's a big push in current third wave businesses to like sort of look down on cold brew or look down on the sort of like iced vanilla, frappuccino, latte, whatever. Just make the drink. Make somebody happy.
I mean, at the end of the day, that's kind of what it's about, right? It's just like, sure, you could mix this mezcal Sprite and it's going to be good to you. But at the end of the day, you know what? It's like your mezcal. You can do whatever you want with it.
Blue cocktails are making a comeback.
Oh, man.
I mean, they're so pretty. I want to be able to take pictures of that.
Well, at what point do you put your foot down? The unicorn latte.
Are you asking me to make me one right now? The unicorn latte.
You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. Shift drink.
There's also the hot buttered latte, the charcoal latte.
I agree that it can sometimes go a little too far.
I've done my research on this.
And what I would say is that as long as the care and that the ingredients going into the drink are respecting the process of getting us to that point, make whatever makes people happy. You know, I think like in specialty, it's always about making sure that every step along the supply chain, people are being taken care of. And I think that there's still a lot of work to do just on the end producer that's doing it at the farm level. And then also environmentally, like it's, you know, there's a lot of improvement that can still be made.
Well, I mean, that actually brings up a question of mine, because I was wondering, like, what's the most responsible way for coffee drinkers to, I mean, like, what should we be looking out for? We are in that third wave of responsible sourcing and fair trade and all that. Is there a way that we could be better coffee drinkers?
It's a really tough question because, you know, places like Starbucks are, and even Nestle now, for all the sort of bad that they do with water, they're actually creating farming projects in developing countries in order to sort of provide more value to the end user, the farmer at the producer level. I think that generally speaking, you know, fair trade is not necessarily the most important thing. If you're working with a specialty roaster that just has really good sourcing practices, the term direct trade can often be thrown around, but it doesn't always mean a lot. But just kind of finding out, I mean, every specialty roaster that you talk to would be more than happy to tell you about how they source, what they're paying for the coffee. I mean, you know, to give you an idea, a bag of coffee that you at the retail level would pay maybe $25 a pound for is usually purchased for around $5 pre-roasted, which doesn't sound like a lot.
Pre-roasted.
But there's weight loss involved, and there's so much that goes into the production of the coffee after it arrives to us
A lot of hands touching it along the way.
There's a lot of hands touching it along the way. And I think that there's a trend to sort of disparage the idea of the middleman, the importer-exporter, but they can do a lot to improve the logistics of the process, and they're a necessary piece of the puzzle. I think, like, as long as you're sourcing responsibly and you're talking to your importers about what people are paying, I think that's the most important thing for me. I don't necessarily go out of my way to look for certifications like organic or fair trade, because oftentimes those certifications cost the farmer money that could be spent improving their livelihood or the livelihood of their farms.
Right.
Is there one thing, one silver bullet that you would say would make the biggest improvement in how we drink coffee today?
I don't think that I prepared for that, unfortunately, but I got nothing off the top of my head. I mean, you know, support roasters and cafes that make an effort to create environmentally sustainable practices. I think that's probably the biggest thing, because we're certainly on a trend right now where coffee as we know it is not going to exist in 20 to 30 years if we don't figure out some practices.
Really?
Or it's just going to be much more expensive.
Right.
Really?
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is why you also do teas very well.
Yeah. thank you for bringing that up, Eddie.
Yes.
That's an aspect of our business that I hadn't really considered until my sort of director of training came on to work with me. He has a lot of experience working in tea houses, and you know, tea is very similar to coffee in terms of terroir and preparation and that sort of thing. And again, it's very ceremonial, and I think it can be very it can be a very mindful experience to drink tea. And so we're working with a couple of importers right now to start sourcing a line of teas for Coronation in order to sort of round out the offerings that we have
very cool,
for our consumers.
Now, I was just up in New York this last weekend, and one of my greatest pleasures every time I go up is to basically walk into the closest bodega and ask for a regular coffee. That's two sugars, some milk.
Mm-hmm.
It's super sweet. It's super guilty.
With the blue and white Greek cup.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We are happy to serve you.
Yeah. But like, I mean, that's my guilty pleasure, right? The coffee's not good, but do you have any guilty pleasure stuff? Like, what's your Starbucks order?
Oh, my Starbucks order is typically some type of like frappe mocha.
Yeah.
I don't know the exact verbiage, but man, is it delicious. I mean, it's essentially a smoothie, right? Like,
right.
It's a sugary smoothie drink, but
yeah.
I love sugar and ice cream just as much as the next guy. So, and that being said too, I think, I'm actually working on a diner line of coffee that's like a little bit cheaper, but is going to sort of fulfill that diner coffee need while also still responsibly sourcing the coffee and making sure that the farmers are being paid what they need to be paid. And
something that stays in a carafe and stays warm.
Something, you know, I want to believe that they're going to make it a little fresher, but I can't always dictate that at the end user level. But I want something in diners that people can be proud to serve, but still fits that need of like diner coffee, which, you know, when I go to a diner, it's two little creamer packets, who knows how long they've been sitting on the table, and two sugars. And I think there's something really nostalgic about that.
On the other side of that spectrum, have you ever thought about doing like a coffee sommelier program, which is like a real thing? I was looking it up.
I'm so impressed by the amount of research that you guys put into this. It's really touching. certainly, as we grow as a company, I'll want to source some more like really interesting small lot coffees. I mean, there are some farmers in basically every coffee growing region that are doing some really progressive things at the farm level. But those coffees are also about $25 to $30 a pound green, which to an end consumer can sometimes translate to upwards of $100.
Yeah.
Which is not necessarily approachable. I try to make it as easy as possible for the people buying coffee from me to do that.
Right.
But I love the idea of it. I think it can really elevate what people think and expect of the drink that they usually have every morning.
Right on. Well, let's transition to, I think it's time to maybe do some rapid fire questions.
Time for the payback. All right.
So we basically ask a series of questions, and we're kind of just hoping that you'll answer kind of tip of tongue, first thing that comes to you. We'll go from there. Yeah.
Be ready. Get in position. Let's do it. All right.
He's still sweating from the whole arm tattoo question.
I'm going to switch it up quite a bit. Away from coffee. So I know you are an avid tennis fan.
Sure.
So first thing to come to your mind, Rafa Nadal or Roger Federer?
Nadal.
Pete Sampras or Mr. Agassi?
Sampras.
Steffi Graf or Monica Seles?
Graf.
Good. Okay.
Okay. You're on Team Eddie right over here.
No, I'm a Roger Federer fan.
Nah, Nadal. he's fire and blood. I want the blood.
I just like the Swiss players.
What is your favorite machine to work with? Slayer, DeLonghi.
Ooh.
Lomas Rocco.
You know, yeah. I actually really love the Slayer Steam. I think it's super nice for repeatability. I think, especially in a place like at the hotel where we have sometimes a number of people coming through to work on it, the fact that I can program a recipe for them has been a dream.
Right on.
Are there a lot of places in the city that have the Slayer?
Not right now. No. In fact, my company, I believe, is still the current only reseller of Slayer in DC. There's only, I think, three or four cafes that are using their equipment. But
We used to have one at the Pineapple Pearl Cafe.
You still do?
Are we using it at Little Pearl?
You're using it at P&P
still. Oh, you're right. Obviously, yeah, we do it for night service. But
yes.
Yeah. We have one at Pineapple Pearl, is what I meant to say. Okay. When was the last time you failed? Quick.
Ooh, I made a really bad purchasing decision on labels, and I basically bit the bullet on a pretty expensive run of coffee can labels that had a spelling error on them.
Ah, bummer.
And I'm telling you that now, hoping that Eric's not listening, because he doesn't know that that was a $500 mistake.
Eric is our number one fan. He always texts at us. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, he left a review on our iTunes.
Eric, I'm sorry.
He likes Matthew as well. Your favorite SNL character?
Bill Hader.
Yes. That's a good choice.
That's a good one.
I just recently watched SNL this a couple weekends ago with Bill Hader.
The Stefan.
To Stefan.
Oh, yeah, man. With John Mulaney. That was
so good. Like, that whole cast right now is fire. They're doing great.
They're hit or miss right now, but I weirdly still love SNL. Like, I'll watch it on Sundays if I'm like working from home, and I'll throw it on.
How about someone from the 80s? 80s SNL character?
A little harder for me to answer. I'm sorry.
Bill Murray, obviously.
I mean, Bill Murray is kind of the classic answer, but I don't say I watch those episodes too often. Eddie Murphy, probably.
We love Bill Murray here.
Yeah,
He's a frequent guest of ours.
Yes.
How's your latte art game? Do you stick to the standards, or can you surprise with something like a cool Yoda?
No, pretty standard. In fact, I basically only pour tulips.
Tulips.
Yeah. That's about it for me. Yeah. I don't often work on the machine anymore. So,
are you someone that does latte art to impress a girl or boy?
You know, I would be remiss to say that I haven't done that. I've been known to re-pour to make sure that the heart's perfect.
I mean, I will say, as a bartender, we make drinks all the time to impress people. So I would assume it's very, very common amongst baristas.
It's been a while since I've been on bar, but I will say that it's a great feeling to see someone pull their cup aside and snap a photo of it.
Eddie Kim, you recently impressed Aubrey Plaza.
Oh,
you can't.
That's like Eddie's permanent woman crush Wednesday. So.
Yeah.
Oh,
wow.
God,
that, good for him.
Wow. You really caught me off guard.
Must have been a big moment for you, bud.
I'm not going to tell you what she drank. I'm not going to tell you what bar that she drank it at. She was in town.
Everybody go to room 11.
Around. I assume she was in town for the March for Our Lives.
You know, she was. She was with Adam Scott, Paul Rudd, and one other person from
Paul Rudd was in town as well.
They were all in town. Joss Whedon was in town too.
What?
I know.
Okay.
My nerd boner just like went off the scale.
All right. Biggest pet peeve you see with other coffee drinkers, etc.
Other coffee drinkers?
Yeah. It's like when people are ordering coffee.
You know, I think probably 2 years ago, it would have sort of been the like extra hot soy milk, two sugars, whatever.
Yeah.
I don't really have pet peeves anymore. I think people like what they like and I'll make it for them.
I'll be honest. I'm going to rant for a second. I don't understand the flat white.
Ooh.
Can you give it a definition? I always forget.
I sure
look it up
can.
On Wikipedia and then I forget again.
I don't know what your minutes. Australian barista sort of listener levels are, but a flat white is basically a 8-ounce latte. So you steam the milk hot like a latte, a little bit less foam than a cappuccino, but it's essentially the same amount of milk as a cappuccino, just steamed hotter and with like a little bit less foam.
So it's a flat cappuccino, but it's a hotter latte.
It's a hotter cappuccino is what I would say.
Okay.
It's the same amount of milk and pretty similar consistency. I'm actually probably not the right person to ask because I steam all of my milks exactly the same texture because this is sort of where I am a purist. I think that there's like one texture that steamed milk tastes really good at. And so I'll like differ the temperature a little bit based on the size of the drink.
What is the magic number?
For me, for cappuccinos, the magic number is 120, which is like very cool.
Yeah.
120 degrees Fahrenheit. That's like borderline
but
too
like
cool,
I mean,
for people.
Do you think people at like Starbucks are like, because like I feel like there's those temperature range for flat whites and like
flat whites.
I never see thermometers and like I'm guessing like.
So Starbucks actually uses thermometers when they steam.
They
flat
do?
White okay. and lattes are like 140 to 150.
Okay.
You'll actually get people that go to Starbucks that are like, I want my latte steamed to 160 degrees, which is like you're burning the milk.
That's
at
absurd.
That point.
Yeah.
But for me, especially in specialty coffee, you kind of get a sense for what 110 degrees, 120, 30, 40 feels like when you're steaming the milk. And it's fairly consistent. I mean, I check myself every so often with a thermocouple, but once you know, that never really goes away.
Actually, really quickly, throwing back to old DC coffee culture, something that was a pet peeve of one prominent coffee person.
Yeah, Nick Cho.
Yes.
Yeah.
The ghetto latte.
I don't know what the ghetto latte is unless it's the iced espresso.
It's iced espresso in a to-go cup, and then you walk over and dump
yes.
a ton of milk in it, which he called the ghetto latte, and then subsequently coined the term junk punch.
That's a fair name for it. I probably wouldn't use the term ghetto because it feels a little,
I know.
You know,
yeah.
inappropriate at this day and age. But yeah, you know, Nick is... I mean, even still is one of the leading voices in specialty coffee. I think he's done a lot of really great things out at Wrecking Ball. And I think that from a sort of like coffee brewing and science-y side of things, he's still at the forefront of doing really awesome things in specialty. I think he probably regrets the way that he was so outspoken about the iced espresso in a to-go cup. Maybe, I don't know, maybe he'll double down on that. I don't know him personally, but... yeah, you know, he was the sort of original specialty coffee purveyor here in D.C. with Murky Coffee in Chinatown. So nothing but respect for that dude.
Right on. And I guess real quick, we'll just end with, we have a couple questions, but favorite beach drink?
Favorite beach drink? Probably pina colada.
It's a classic.
Love that coconut.
Frozen or shaken?
Frozen.
Frozen.
Yeah. Give me the machine. I don't even mind, you know, just really sugary. Stir it up.
Okay, and for our last question, it's more of a game, so we will start playing Marry, Fuck, Kill.
Marry, Kill.
All right. Well, we know what we should have asked now, because we...
Oh, boy, yeah, I'm glad you're not, actually, because my answer is probably not appropriate. So let's do the one that you guys had written down.
Okay. This is kind of super nerdy. It's brew methods.
Great. No, totally.
The pour over, hot siphon, which is what I have, just for the record, and the French press.
Which is what I prefer.
Yeah.
So you're basically marrying, fuck, killing, or Eddie and myself, yeah.
I'm definitely killing the siphon. I think that is one of the worst methods of brew preparation ever made. I think it looks really cool, but...
Great ritual.
It is a great ritual. But boy, you know, we had the siphons at Makedo for a long time, and when I came in there to sort of take over the cafe, that was the first thing I got rid of.
Wow. You killed me.
I'm sorry. I'm going to fuck the pour over. I think that that's like the sexiest of brewing methods, and I think you can elicit the best flavors from it. I'm going to marry the French press because, like...
Oh, you get on your knees when you propose to Eddie.
much like... Your life partner, the French press, is just easy, convenient, and always tastes good.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Ladies, I'm single, so.
All right. Well, thank you, Larry, for being on our show today and for joining us. You can revisit this week's episodes or previous episodes on iTunes or wherever you grab your podcasts. Don't forget, we want to see your shift drinks on Instagram or Twitter by using the hashtag Show Us Your Shifty, and follow us as at ShiftDrink on all social medias. Sorry, at ShiftDrink DC.
I want to give a special thank you to Jeffrey Lemereau for doing our intro music, what a wonderful bass and drum line, and DJ RecTech for our great sound effects.
He's kind of the man.
I'm going to give a quick shout out to at Coronation Coffee on Instagram.
Yeah.
About to pop off, so please follow.
You're working on a new website. Sorry.
New website and Instagram launching this week, so
hold on to your butts.
Thanks for having me this week. It was well timed.
Next week we welcome special guest Bill Murray as we discuss modern theories in wine tasting. Sip or swallow.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts, covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.